Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. In fast-moving developments over the weekend and on Monday, a tentative deal between software company Oracle and TikTok's China-based parent ByteDance appeared on the verge of fraying. President Trump gave his blessing on Saturday, but the companies have since clashed over pretty fundamental issues of ownership. That leaves tens of millions of TikTok users wondering what's next. And the tech world is watching and worrying about government overreach. Washington Post technology reporter Rachel Lerman has been covering the issue. Welcome, Rachel.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Let's start with the latest news. Oracle and Walmart reached a tentative deal with ByteDance that would give TikTok an owner in the U.S. Why is it on the verge of coming apart?
So Oracle and Walmart are saying that if TikTok creates this new company, which basically would separate it from its Chinese owner, then they'll take together a 20% stake of that company. President Trump seemed to give it his blessing this weekend, but then he said that if ByteDance, a Chinese company, had anything to do with it, he wouldn't approve it. And we're hearing conflicting reports. ByteDance is saying they'll still own 80% of this entity, but Oracle is saying, no, they won't own any piece of it. So it's unclear exactly what's going on, which makes the deal pretty uncertain.
Well, if Oracle and Walmart have 20%, it's 20 each?
Is it, no, it's 20% together.
Right. Oracle, I mean, somebody else has to own the rest of it. I mean, it's just, to me, it's implied that it would still be ByteDance, but they'd have American partners.
Well, we're hearing, yeah, exactly. We're hearing from some sources that the makeup of the new company would mirror that of ByteDance. So ByteDance's founder would have a share, and some ByteDance employees would, as well as some American VC firms and European VC firms that currently are part of ByteDance. They would also own part of the company. So that's possible, but Trump said Monday on Fox News that if the Chinese companies had anything to do with it, he wouldn't bless it. So it's unclear if that's really what's going on or if he blessed something that he thought was different this weekend or what.
And what's the deal with Walmart? I mean, I get the Oracle thing, but I don't really understand. I mean, is this just because Walmart, you know, they have the money to do this kind of a deal so quickly?
It's totally an e-commerce play. It's a shopping play.
Okay.
So many teens and young adults use TikTok that the advertisements on there are seen by, you know, millions of people. And so they can try to push people toward their e-commerce channels.
And then, how can President Trump derail an agreement between a tech company and a foreign-owned company? I mean, how much of a right does he have to do that? Has he really made the case that this is a danger to Americans?
So, a lot. It seems that the final decision actually does rest with him because of these two orders that he signed in August. The first one would have banned TikTok beginning Sunday, although they got an extension on that. But the second one is through this process called the CFIUS process, which is this interagency committee that looks at foreign company mergers with American companies. And they said that ByteDance had to divest from TikTok in the U.S., and President Trump signed that. So basically what we're dealing with here is this process that is usually just very kind of dry and looks specifically at mergers, but has caught the eye of the president. So now if the companies don't reach a proposal that satisfies that process, he can ban them.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher, and I'm talking with Washington Post technology reporter Rachel Lerman about the ongoing story regarding Oracle and Walmart reaching a tentative deal with ByteDance to give TikTok an owner in the U.S., which is what the president ordered. But now it looks like the deal isn't clean enoughly done for the president. He said last week that the U.S. would ban TikTok and WeChat downloads from mobile app stores as of this past Sunday. And you said that that was pushed back. Now, I remember him specifically saying there will be no extensions, and apparently there was an extension, right?
Right, exactly. So TikTok got a one-week extension, pushing it to next Sunday at midnight. And WeChat actually had a successful injunction put in place, so that lawsuit is pending in California court.
And people in the U.S. use WeChat to talk with relatives in China. How would they be affected?
It's a big deal. WeChat is used as a main communication tool between, you know, people that live here and their family or friends in China, as well as businesses that have offices in China. Because so many other apps are banned in China, there's kind of limited options for what you can use to essentially text other people in China. Like Facebook is banned there and WhatsApp and a lot of these things that we kind of take for granted. So they would have to switch to one of these very few other apps that are allowed in China, and there's not a lot of options.
All right, so call me a rebel, but as soon as I knew that the president tried was going to ban TikTok, I joined. I got TikTok, and I kind of avoided it because I knew I'd probably become an addict, which I probably have by now. And but what about other people out there? Is there an uptick in interest in TikTok now that somebody's saying you can't have it?
Yeah, actually, we did see some of the download spike this summer. And I mean, it especially saw a huge surge during quarantine because, like you said, yeah, it's really addictive and quite fun.
Yeah.
And people needed some way to spend the time.
Yeah, it's a lot more fun than I even thought it would be. It's quite delightful. So it's getting more popular then in the midst of all of this. What President Trump has said that he imposed the U.S. ownership conditions because of concerns that the Chinese government controls ByteDance, that it could use the technology for nefarious reasons. What kind of evidence is there to support that?
Yeah, it's tough. So he's basically saying there's national security concerns because, so, you know, they're collecting so much information on American users, and oh, what if TikTok via ByteDance is giving that to the Chinese government? I mean, as far as we can tell, none of the traffic is actually reaching China out of the app, and TikTok has said over and over again that it stores all U.S. data in the U.S. with backups in Singapore. But the issue is that China does exert a lot of control over the companies within its jurisdiction. So the government's concern is, okay, well, even if it's not happening now, who's to stop it from happening in the future if we don't have some sort of transparency into the data practices over at TikTok?
Would the ban apply to downloads for all users or just new users, or how would that work?
So the first part of the ban that would now take place this next Sunday would just stop the U.S. app stores from carrying the app. So if you already have it on your phone, you can still use it, but you wouldn't be able to get updates, which can be security issues. But the second part of the ban, which takes place on November 12th, is much more strict, and it would basically stop American companies from hosting TikTok's internet traffic, which is just kind of like jargony way of saying that it wouldn't work. You wouldn't be able to post things. You wouldn't be able to really scroll through without using some sort of VPN workaround that most people won't take the time to figure out. So the stricter ban comes November 12th. So if they don't have a deal before that, it's possible and probable that you won't really be able to use it in the U.S.
And what are other countries doing about this?
India banned TikTok earlier this year over national security concerns. They have something more similar to China's Great Firewall, where they actually stopped the traffic from going to TikTok, so you really can't use it there. But other than that, we haven't heard much from other countries. For a while, when it looked like maybe Microsoft was going to buy TikTok, it was possible that they would buy their operations in Australia as well. But that seems to kind of have fizzled out.
Yeah. Why did it end up Oracle and Walmart? What happened to the other players in all of this?
Yeah. So Microsoft seemed to be the leading suitor for a while. It looked like it was going to buy TikTok. But, a couple things happened. The Chinese government said that it would also have to approve the deal, which made a full sale a lot less likely. And it doesn't seem like Microsoft was really interested in anything other than buying the whole of TikTok.
Okay.
And then TikTok kind of wrangled its way into getting this partial sale. So, I mean, it's not really selling its whole company. It's just kind of creating its own entity where it still controls a lot of its own operations. Mm-hmm. And Oracle was a way to do that because Oracle, an American company, can come in and take control of the technical side and be able to oversee that data, but not actually own the company. Oracle has really good relationships with President Trump and the government, so that was kind of an attractive offer.
How big of a deal was the Microsoft plan compared to the deal with Oracle and Walmart? I mean, how much money are we talking about here?
It's a good question. There were a lot of numbers floating around. It's, some people were saying that TikTok was worth as much as $50 billion in the private markets, which Microsoft probably wouldn't have paid that much for it. But Microsoft would have wholly owned TikTok, so it would have become kind of like LinkedIn, where it operates as its own company, but it is owned by Microsoft. Uh-huh. Whereas now we're looking at a TikTok that probably looks very similar to like it is now, just with some additional investment from Oracle and Walmart.
And how are other tech companies watching this? What are their concerns?
So we know they're watching it closely, although a lot of them haven't been speaking super publicly about it. The one person that did is the Instagram CEO, Adam Mosseri, who said that he was concerned about the ban just last week because of kind of the precedent it could set about government reach into mm-hmm, technology. Mm-hmm. This would be the first time that a large consumer app like this was banned from the app store by the government. We see them do this when there's like legal concerns or criminal activities, but a huge consumer app like this, it hasn't happened.
Well, I just wonder because it's just I'm wondering about the evidence to support the assertions that the Chinese are using it nefariously, and that if we don't get really super concrete evidence, then going forward, does that suggest that, you know, he could ban other apps without concrete evidence?
Yeah, I mean, right. I think that that's the concern of the tech industry. I think that he has a lot of political momentum behind him with this deal, especially because of the escalating tensions between D.C. and Beijing.
Uh-huh.
And so that's kind of feeding into it here.
And just one more quick question before I let you go. The Congress has been very reluctant to take any, to make any moves to regulate the internet and online and apps and all of that, digital regulation. What's Congress saying?
So some lawmakers have come out and said, okay, yes, we think there might be some legitimate security concerns with TikTok, though we're not sure if this is the way to handle it. But you make a really good point, which is that the American companies, Facebook, Google, Twitter, et cetera, are all also collecting a massive amount of information from us. Mm-hmm. And although it's been talked about for a couple of years, we have no kind of comprehensive federal internet privacy law.
Right. Now, they do in the European Union. So I'm wondering if that applies to TikTok.
To a certain extent, it would, yeah, because the European Union has some right to forget and you can kind of better see where your data is going and things like that. So they are subject to GDPR there. But the issue here is that, I mean, currently in the U.S., the strongest privacy law is in California, but it only protects those that live within California.
Gotcha. Oh, Rachel Lerman, thanks for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Rachel Lerman is a technology reporter at The Washington Post, and she has been covering developments over the weekend on Monday of the tentative deal between software company Oracle and TikTok's China-based parent ByteDance. We'll continue to follow that story here on Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. The Democratic voter targeting firm Catalyst has projected that about 156 million people could vote in the November 3rd presidential election. That's 17 million more than in 2016. But many American voters, for one reason or another, are leery of the process. The president has cast doubt on mail-in voting, and history has shown that in-person voting has its own challenges, starting with the reliability and the security of voting machines. And importantly, voters want to get a tangible confirmation of their votes. Microsoft is at work on a new system to achieve all of that. Benjamin Wofford is a contributor at Wired. His story, Lone Star, is part of a special editorial package in Wired's October issue examining efforts to reboot the American voting system. Welcome to the show, Benjamin.
Hi, Ann. Great to be here.
First of all, I want to just jump right way ahead and just ask you about the issue of tangible confirmation of votes. That's something that's sort of sacrosanct in American voting law, because you cannot walk out of a voting booth with a paper showing who you voted for. That's against the law.
Right. So in the United States, for the last 120-odd years, our system has been based on a foundational principle called the secret ballot. It's the idea that you can't sell your vote to someone because you can't prove who you voted for. It's actually sort of a beguiling and simple idea. But when we adopted that principle, in the late 1800s, around the 1890s to be exact, mm-hmm. we made a fundamental trade-off. We said that we were going to enshrine privacy at the cost of transparency, because once your anonymous ballot goes into a sea of other ballots, it becomes disassociated from you. And so much of what we think of as the process of voting, voter registration, the notion of adversarial poll watchers, the notion of keeping track of who enters and leaves the polling place, for instance, are all artifacts built around sort of the fundamental magic act that's going on in the polling place, which is a system of disappearing ballots. And the question is, could we imagine or envision, with the help of technology and some really interesting and sometimes advanced math, a world in which this canyon between privacy and transparency could be bridged?
Now, I remember a couple, I don't think it was 2016. I think in 2016, I had to carry something over to somebody. It showed what I voted for, but I couldn't take it out of the building. I had to bring it over to somebody. I could look at it, and then I had to bring it over to somebody. And in other cases, a voting machine would show me through a plastic window a receipt of what I had done, so I could check that. Is that still trying kind of preserving that secrecy thing at the expense of disconnecting me to my ballot?
Yes. Yeah, so what you're describing, and again, you're actually gesturing towards an important fact that needs to be acknowledged whenever we're talking about technology innovations around voting, which mm-hmm. is that we have a system of 3,000, really 10,000 little elections going on in the United States. There is no one presidential election. You know, two counties in Ohio may have different procedures, and of course, different states may have different procedures. So, Anne, what you've just described is, you know, the notion of a voter verified auditable paper trail.
Yeah.
Some machines will have that. It's a record of your vote, but it doesn't have your name on it, and it goes into a box. And in the very rare instance that, you know, Ohio's, you know, vote for a senator or president truly came down to the wire, you know, every state's laws are different, but presumably Ohio does have a law that says if the election is within a tiny, tiny margin, we'll go back into those boxes. They're literally kept in a warehouse, you know, somewhere out in Cincinnati, maybe. Just warehouses full of those receipts that you saw on your machine, but they don't have your name on it. And when they counted those receipts after the audit, or if they counted the votes the first time when you gazed up at the TV on CNN on election night, all of us look at a big number that says, you know, 50 million votes for Trump, 49 million votes for Hillary Clinton. And we all kind of wonder, hey, you know, I know I voted for Trump, or I know I voted for Clinton. I wonder if my vote is part of that 49 million. you know, we have a certain kind of faith that our votes are counted, partly because of the persistence and competence of local officials at the local level who really do a fantastic job of making sure the ballots get counted. But all of us on election night, when we look at the screen and we look at the tallies, don't really know that our ballot was counted or it was counted as cast. And the reason for that is the anonymous secret ballot. And so the question is, could you use a branch of math, in this case, a branch of math called homomorphic cryptography, that can do neat tricks basically to preserve the secrecy of the ballot, but also give us insight that the ballot that you submitted, you and Fisher, was actually counted and counted the way that you cast it. That would truly be a revolution. And to do that, it's taken a lot of technological know-how and a lot of hard work on this branch of math. But Microsoft has gotten very interested in this project, and they're working on a way to make this kind of technology available to voters in the next few years.
There was that it's Microsoft's Election Guard, and it was tested in a small Wisconsin town in February, I guess, for a primary vote. But the results weren't used in the final tabulation. So how did that test go? What did they do?
It's a vision of what American voting could look like in the future in this tiny town of Fulton, Wisconsin. About 398 people in this small village, about an hour of Milwaukee, came in the cold winter of February for a primary race, voting in the local Supreme Court and the school board. And what they did was they voted in exactly the normal way that they vote. In this case, these were punch card scan type voting machines. Remember, there are sort of dozens of different configurations of voting machines. But what Election Guard set up in addition to that was sort of an adjunct station in which your vote would be scanned and encrypted. The vote would be scanned and encrypted. And what that means is that the data of your vote is converted into ones and zeros, and then those ones and zeros are turned into a ciphertext. This is a part of a more or less standard process of encryption. And that ciphertext then gets condensed down into a hash code. Think of it the way that a URL gets condensed down into a bit.ly or a tiny URL. And so what the voter can then do is take that receipt home with them. So remember, Anne, you were saying that you could look through the glass and see your auditable ballot, but you couldn't take it home. You couldn't leave the polling place with it, right? Because then you could show someone how you voted. But if you have a receipt that's a hash code of hexadecimal gibberish, you can't, it doesn't reveal who you voted for. But what you can do is you can take it home and sit on your computer and look at the sea of ballots, encrypted ballots, that have been recorded. And for the first time, and in fact, this is what the voters in Fulton, Wisconsin were able to do, they can look at their computer screen just like the way you and I might look at our banking statement to verify that something we bought really was the thing we bought and the amount we paid is what we paid for it, and see that their receipt matches the encrypted ballot that was cast under that encryption hash code in the collection of ballots. And so it's sounds like a small extra step, but if you think about it, it really is rather revolutionary. We have come to expect everything in our life to be verifiable in the digital age. And that credit card example is not a bad one. If you bought a stereo for $100, but noticed a flat screen TV for $1,000 that you didn't buy, you know, we can verify that quickly and a credit card company can step in and intervene. But if your ballot gets jammed in the gears or lost in the mail, which is a concern this year, or simply got, the punch card, for instance, didn't count exactly as it should have, as happened in Bush v. Gore, right? You have no notion of whether or not your ballot really was counted. This is a way to give transparency and insight into whether your vote is counted and counted as cast. And that's a real change, actually the first big change categorically of the way that Western democracies have voted in 100 years. It's a really big deal.
How do they manage the encryption? Does it change with, I mean, are there like a rotating kind of encryption? I'm trying to figure out, because couldn't somebody figure it out, the encryption, eventually?
Right.
Or would it change?
Explaining this type of encryption is incredibly difficult. It's not quite like, you know,
Einstein had to me.
Right. Well, I'm not a ones and zeros guy either. But, you know, when Einstein had a theory of relativity, you know, supposedly there were only six people in the world who could understand it. This isn't quite that complex, but here's the idea. Encryption is, for now, as close to airtight safe a method of security as is known to man. I mean, in fact, that's the reason why almost all of our lives rely on encryption, right? When we send a credit card statement, or we send a money wire, for instance, or we communicate on apps like Signal that ensure the protection of journalists and their sources, all of that is using encryption. Encryption is basically taking a data set of ones and zeros and multiplying it by an impossibly, unimaginably large prime number, and basically using a set of keys to unlock that prime number. And the prime number and the multiplication sum is so vast that, you know, it would take 3 or 4 billion years, for instance, you know, for a computer that any person can design to crack the code.
Okay.
The problem with encrypting votes is not whether or not the encryption can be broken, right? The problem is whether or not you can find a way to add up the votes once they're encrypted. That's what's so exciting about this, right? So imagine that encrypting a vote, right, would be like taking your vote, Anne, and your physical ballot and sticking it in a lockbox, you know, turning the key and swallowing the key, and it's in the lockbox. No one can see it. It's locked in there. How would you add a vote like that? You can't see it. You can't look at it.
Right.
It's locked. And so what homomorphic cryptography allows you to do, it's a breakthrough that takes encrypted values and finds a way to add them together, even though the ballot content is secret, right? So it sounds like it's magic almost, right? But even though I can't know, you know, I've got a ballot and it's turned over, and another ballot and it's turned over. You know, if I were looking at the backside of two blank pieces of paper, homomorphic cryptography is a way to add those two ballots together, even though we can't see what the encrypted values of those ballots are. The basic way to understand this is, you know, imagine you had an encryption of the number 2 and an encryption of the number 4, and you wanted to add them together, 2 plus 4. The homomorphic cryptographic protocol would let you add the encryption of 2 and the encryption of 4, and the result would be a new encryption of the number 6. And you could then decrypt that final number and know the tally and know how many votes went to Biden, how many votes went to Trump, even though the votes themselves are encrypted. And that's the breakthrough that Microsoft is trying to engineer.
And when you say you could, what you're meaning is a computer's doing all of this.
Right. Now, let's be clear. You know, technology will not solve all of our problems. There is a huge role for the human element here in how you would design a system like this. In this case, you would need to give a special set of keys that would only go to a very small group of people, you know, say 5 people, maybe the county clerk or the county commissioner and the state secretary of state. You know, imagine the, launch sequence from the James Bond movies where the villain have 2 keys and they turn them at the same time to launch the nuclear missile. It would be a bit like that. But, you know, there is one very interesting point that you touch on here when you say, who is doing the decrypting? One of the other reasons to do this, and one of the reasons Microsoft is doing it, in addition to you and I being able to go home and have this receipt that proves who we voted for, a huge revolutionary step. But there's something else you can do when you go down this rabbit hole. One of the things you can do is, because the code is open source, and because the encryption is out there in the open, remember, just because something's open source and viewable doesn't mean it's insecure. It just means you can interact with the data, you can interact with the code. What that allows you to do is to write a verifier program to run through the math and make sure that the tally of these encrypted votes is correct. And so one of the really exciting things that Microsoft is talking about doing is allowing individual people to write their own verifier programs to actually make sure that the winner of the presidential election really is the winner of the presidential election. Now, Ann Fisher and Ben Wofford probably are not going to get our math PhDs anytime soon and learn how to write this verifier program. But organizations who could write a verifier program like this might be the League of Women Voters. It might be the Wall Street Journal. It might be the Republican National Committee. You could imagine civic groups actually writing their own verifier programs, and one day in the not so distant future, having an app on your phone, you know, from the NAACP or from the Sierra Club that lets you run the math on the homomorphic protocol and actually verify that the encrypted ballots add up to the winner that CNN is saying is the winner. You know, it would take something that I think most of us take for granted as a kind of act of civic faith and bring it into the era of verifiable math in this kind of radical act of democracy.
How election guard is not going to be used in November. What's the outlook for when it's usable? And furthermore, one of the issues that I've covered over the years in public affairs reporting and political reporting is the fact that every is what you brought up is there's like 10,000 little elections going on out there. How would this could you achieve any kind of reliable uniformity of this? Or would it be just wealthy big city counties, that kind of a thing?
You know, it's a perfect question because our, you know, vast variation and multiplicity of voting styles is both our greatest strength in some areas and also our greatest weakness. You know, it's a great strength, frankly, concerns about election meddling. You know, one of the reasons we know that the Russians, for instance, or the Chinese, you know, they could dicky around with all sorts of things. There's lots of reasons to be concerned, but there's no reason to believe a foreign adversary could change votes. You'd have to, you know, have a spy, you know, in 10,000 different jurisdictions. Mm-hmm. But it also means that adopting a really big innovation that requires a lot of buy-in is very difficult. So the world that I sort of described to you a minute ago, you know, where we might one day have an app on our phone that could tell us who won the presidential election is probably a pipe dream. But what's more likely is that one day you might have an app on your phone if you could get the state of Rhode Island to buy into this system. You know, you could imagine it starts on small states.
Yeah.
But this is a decision that is ultimately left to voters. Voters elect governors, or sometimes they elect secretaries of state individually. If they read this story and liked what Microsoft is doing, the prototypes are supposed to be available starting to roll out in 2021 and hopefully for a ready use case by 2022.
And they just look like normal voting machines, whatever those are?
Yeah, so this is actually an SDK, a software development kit. It's imagine like the little sidecar on the side of a motorcycle.
Okay.
So it's designed to sort of be an accessory that voters ideally wouldn't even notice. The act of voting wouldn't feel any different, but there would be a process built into the way that the ballots move through a polling place that would allow for this kind of encryption. You know, the question is, once voters actually find out what's going on, will they like it? It's not necessarily a guarantee that they are. And remember, knowledge is power, but there's also something we call the curse of knowledge. So it's a wonderful democratic sort of utopian idea that all of us could go home and take a receipt and verify our vote was counted. But if everyone knows that their vote is counted, and there's a an incredibly sophisticated hacker, you know, in Russia, for instance, that can penetrate some other part of the voting system and meddle with our, election reporting, for instance, you can imagine that knowing exactly how you voted might not actually be such a great thing. It means it's incredibly sensitive to even the slightest perturbation in the way that the election is administered. If everybody knows exactly how they voted, it's a little bit like, the customer is always right. And you can imagine that that kind of individualist, consumerist mentality of knowing exactly how you voted, but, you know, thinking the outcome went in a different direction than the one you would have liked could encourage more people to allege that the election was rigged. So notions of trust, notions of civic buy-in are bigger than things that technology can solve. All this technology will do is grant us the power of knowledge. And the question is whether, as a democratic society, we're ready for that step.
Well, Benjamin Wofford, contributor at Wired, thank you so much for your time today, giving me a lot to think about.
I'm delighted. I had fun. Thanks, Ann.
You bet. His article is part of a series of articles that examine efforts to reboot the American voting system. We'll have a link to it on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. We have more Tech Tuesday coming up with Russell Holley from Android Central. So stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Fitness apps by Google and Apple have been praised as helpful tools to get users moving. But for those with mobility issues, the apps are anything but helpful, apparently. One reviewer who uses a wheelchair has criticized the lack of inclusiveness. Android Central contributing editor Russell Holley is going to tell us more. Welcome back, Russell.
Hey, thank you.
So a writer for Android Central, Jerry Hildenbrand, said his Apple Watch and Google device know he uses a wheelchair, but still remind him every hour to stand up and walk. Why would the company not create an opportunity to automatically disable that?
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the big questions. I've been a, you know, Jerry's been a friend and a colleague for almost 5 years now, and he's been, you know, wheelchair bound the entire time. He's you know, a very active individual, but, you know, the watch, doesn't matter who makes it. It's, you know, Samsung, Apple, Google, they all do the same thing. You know, every hour you get a little buzz on your wrist that says, hey, it's time to stand up.
Right.
And you can't do that. And as a matter of fact, it actually is, you know, Fitbit includes an incentive structure in, you know, the amount of points that it gives you per day. And you know, Google and Apple included in their kind of fitness metric, they give you special awards if you stand up, you know, once a day for 12 hours and then, you know, do that throughout an entire week. And so, it's not just the kind of day-to-day tracking. If Jerry or someone else in a wheelchair were to engage in a fitness competition through the Apple Watch with someone, they actually lose by default because they can get the same number of fitness minutes in. But their stand goal isn't the same. There is no way to augment that stand goal for someone who is disabled in this way.
Okay, so we can put a man on the moon.
Right.
I just really have. Well, how do the tech companies respond to this?
Right now, it's, you know, the response is that it's something that they're working on. You know, being inclusive is something that Apple and Google both, you know, certainly claim a great deal of focus on. But we know when it comes to the fitness activities, I think a lot of this, you know, comes from guidance from medical professionals. And very rarely is there kind of sub guidance in there for differently abled people, you know, the folks who, you know, don't have use of their, you know, arms or legs or, you know, have very specific mobility arrangements.
Right.
You can set the Apple Watch to, you know, a certain difficulty threshold, but it doesn't really focus on anything else. And what's really fascinating about that is, you know, as Jerry points out in the article, when setting up these fitness things, he has the ability to say, you know, that he's in a wheelchair because it uses different metrics when he's in a wheelchair for measuring his movement. You know, it focuses more on arm movements as he's moving the wheelchair around as opposed to trying to interpret steps
right.
that you would be taking throughout the day. So, you know, the software knows, it just doesn't think it, the people designing it just haven't thought it all the way through.
Well, it's kind of insensitive.
Yeah, incredibly so, you know, and it's got to be deeply frustrating, you know, for no matter what fitness thing you put on to have it scold you once an hour to get up when you literally cannot.
So what's the end game here? I mean, is it something that Jerry Hildenbrand is going to monitor and follow? And should we be following up on this?
Yeah, this is something that's going to be followed up on for the next little while. It's something that, you know, Google has at the very least responded to immediately and said, hey, this is actually something that, you know, we didn't think about and we're going to look at. So I would expect that it's something, you know, over the course of the next year, we start to see kind of more traction on because You know, especially when it comes to Apple and Fitbit, we're seeing these wrist devices be a lot more than just fitness trackers, so much as whole health monitors. You know, the Fitbit Sense has a temperature sensor and sleep tracking and stress monitoring through skin measurement. And we know that the new Apple Watch is going to be doing some similar things there. So as this becomes more of a whole health thing and the sale, the sales pitch here becomes, you know, wear this and you know, it's actually going to help monitor your vitals throughout the day. You know, there are going to be a lot of differently abled folks who are going to be encouraged to do this.
Right. You have your technology your way.
Right.
Right. Hey, Twitter, over the weekend, Twitter users demonstrated examples of Twitter's photo preview showing white faces more often than black faces. How was that preference for white faces discovered? How did that work?
Yeah, so this was actually kind of a shocking experiment that got revealed over the weekend. Someone created a special image it was a pair of images, one that had two faces, one above the other. And in one of the demonstrations that was done, it was Barack Obama on top and Mitch McConnell on the bottom, and then they reversed them and posted them side by side. And in both images, Twitter's algorithm focused on Mitch McConnell. And actually, you couldn't tell that Barack Obama's face was there at all unless you clicked on the image and it showed you the full image, because Twitter, tends to kind of automatically crop some images to focus on what it thinks is the important part of the image. And in the process of testing this, it found that there was a relatively significant bias towards white faces in this algorithm to crop in on, and not just for humans. The kind of the bizarrest part of this was, when Lego figures were sat side by side with one another and similar processes were taken, it focused on the white-faced Lego character over the black-faced one.
And so do they understand why this is happening?
Twitter says that this is absolutely not intentional, and they're looking into it right now to see what's going on. You know, this is one of several examples that have come up in recent history of algorithmic bias, where the people designing the algorithm, don't see anything wrong with what's happening because their skin color is the default. And that as you go and see more happening as algorithms go and kind of dictate things, it kind of helps highlight that, having a computer automatically go and sort things is maybe not always the best if the people designing that software are not of a diverse background. And so, this is something that will likely be resolved in relatively short order, and I suspect from Twitter's perspective, probably turned off until they can find a result for it.
Yeah.
But it really kind of highlights some of the underlying, kind of social structures there behind building these robots to do the work for us.
One Twitter designer said that it's a cropping issue, and I'm trying to figure out how that works.
Yeah, so the idea here is that if someone posts a big photo of something and there's a person, if there's a person sitting there, the software will choose to crop in on what the software thinks is the most important part of the picture. But that's kind of deeply insensitive to say that according to our software, the most important part of the picture is this white guy.
Well, there have been criticisms of that, now that you mention it, of how photos are being cropped. And that makes me wonder about other situations that we've heard about, like demonstrators gathered in a group and it's focusing on the white people, not the blacks the group.
There's that, and then there are a lot of photo sensor companies that are facing issues where skin color is running into issues. There was tattooed ink on black skin was actually something that was stopping the original heart rate monitor on the Apple Watch from adequately reading the heart rate because it wasn't something that was tested. There are a lot of automated antibacterial dispensers where you put your hand under and it dispenses some of the hand sanitizer for you.
Yeah.
That don't work with black skin.
Wow.
In a lot of situations where you put your hand under and it doesn't work, and then another, a white person puts their hand under and it works just fine. There are tiny examples like this all over the place, and it ultimately comes down to the software was not tested for people that don't look like the people who built it.
Right. Interesting. Wow. new Apple Watches, Series 6 and SE. They have a new blood oxygen sensor. We bought one of those little things for our fingers in case we get sick.
Yeah.
But that's kind of the big new thing, right? And it's
going
to cost
$400.
Yeah,
being able to do the blood oxygen thing, it's actually, you know, remarkably prescient that a blood oxygen sensor is included in Apple Watch.
Yeah, I know. It's not like they started planning it last spring.
Right. This is, you know, these things are often quite in, you know, detailed in the pipeline for you know, a year ahead of time. But in a world where people are having conversations about whether wearing something on your face is actually stopping blood from or oxygen from reaching your blood, this test is really kind of fascinating to have that, you know, just kind of part of this new Apple Watch. But this is also the first Apple Watch where there are actually two different models, in very much the same way that the iPhone has a more expensive, more featureful model and a less expensive, you know, kind of model for people who kind of want just a basic Apple Watch. We now have these two versions in the Apple Watch SE, which is a not quite as fast. The screen's not quite as bright. It's a little thinner and it's noticeably less expensive. And then this Apple Watch Series 6, which comes in a lot of different colors and has a significantly brighter screen than its predecessor and has this new blood oxygen sensor for people who are interested in paying that kind of top-tier price for the watch.
They said it's not a diagnostic tool. It's just sort of something just to make people more aware of this and maybe look for oxygen levels, and it tells you when to go get help.
Apple is very, very careful, especially last year when it released the heart rate sensor, the more advanced heart rate sensor for measuring for like tachycardia and things like that, to make sure to point out at every opportunity that your Apple Watch is not a doctor, and that you can use this data and show it to a doctor and say, I've collected this information, maybe this is helpful to you, and the doctor can use that information to make a diagnosis, but to not rely on a computer on your wrist to make medical decisions for you. So it's really just another data point, not a definitive sensor. On the other hand, you are significantly more likely to call a doctor if your watch says, hey, your heart's acting funny, or hey, your blood oxygen level is way low and you feel not quite right. Most people are likely to combine those two things and then immediately call a doctor, whereas, you know, otherwise they may have decided to go and lay down or something like that. And so this, you know, this has the advantage in many cases we've seen documented over the last year of encouraging people to go get checked out and finding problems much earlier.
And do we know anything about its accuracy?
It's as accurate as a lot of the same, you know, ones that you clip onto your finger.
Okay.
There hasn't been a ton of side-by-side comparison with some of the really high-end medical ones yet. But this is, this is definitely very similar to ones that you would buy in a commercial setting or use at home.
Well, we're just about out of time, so I guess maybe next week we talk about the price war brewing for games and controllers.
Yeah, that should be interesting.
Okay, well, stand by for that. In the meantime, Russell Holly, thanks as always for your time. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me in.
Russell Holly, contributing editor at Android Central. He joins us every week on Tech Tuesday. Thanks to you for joining us. This has been Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.